I'm Jessica Lilly, and you're Inside Appalachia. This week, we hear that the number of jobs created by the Kentucky bourbon distillery industry has doubled in the last 2 years.
I love the fact that these new jobs that are being created are paying an average of $91,000 a year per job.
And we'll talk with Elizabeth Wells McElvain, who helps employ 1,000 people in West Virginia, making Fiesta ware.
I'm very proud to have kept this business here in the Ohio Valley. It's very important to us.
And we'll explore some eccentric roadside attractions, including the Ventriloquist Museum in Fort Mitchell, Kentucky.
But this is the only museum of its kind in the world. Everybody else's collections are private, and they just show them to their friends.
You'll find these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome, Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. More than 60 years into her career, trailblazing folk singer Alice Gerard is still exploring the darker corners of the folk music tradition. Gerard recorded some of the most influential folk albums of the 1960s with her collaborator, the late Hazel Dickens. Gerard just celebrated her 80th birthday, and she's made an album with a new collaborator, an up-and-coming rocker who wasn't even born when Gerard made her first records. NPR's Joel Rose has the story.
Alice Gerard is best known for being half of one of country music's first female duos.
Some blues are just blues, mine are the miner's blues. Some blues are just blues, mine are the miner's blues.
Alice Gerard and Hazel Dickens started playing together at folk music parties around Baltimore and Washington, D.C. in the early 1960s. Gerard says they were sort of an odd couple. Dickens was older, from West Virginia. Gerard was younger. She'd gone to college, but she didn't grow up around the music the way Dickens had.
You know, I was aware that I was the learner in this situation, and Hazel was the teacher. I was learning from her. I was kind of hippie, you know, and she was kind of more streetwise, you know, and she was always saying, oh, you got to comb your hair, and you got to wear a skirt.
But when their voices came together in songs about hard times and heartbreak, the chemistry was unmistakable.
A boy and girl once loved each other more than this world will ever know. But the girl, she took that old consumption. It broke the boy's heart, you know.
Dickens and Gerard made a handful of records together in the 1960s and 70s, and they inspired other women, including Emmylou Harris, to sing bluegrass, which until then was mostly a men's club. Their music also influenced a younger generation of fans.
It felt very genuine. It felt simple, in a way, and I don't use that as a pejorative term at all. It felt like the songs were the most important thing.
MC Taylor is a singer and songwriter who performs under the name His Golden Messenger. He also produced Alice Gerard's new album, but long before he met Gerard, Taylor was a fan of her records.
I remember coming across the Hazel and Alice record, the gray one with the really striking photograph of the two of them on the cover.
We're just looking right into the camera, and there's something kind of spare about it, too, and I think that was true of our music on that recording.
Get up, Rounder.
Let a working girl lay down.
Get up, Rounder.
When the duo broke up in the 1970s, Alice Gerard kept learning about traditional music.
I've always sort of had one foot in music to play and then one foot in documenting the music and the musicians.
In the 1980s, Gerard moved from Washington, D.C. to southwestern Virginia to be closer to the old-time musicians who still lived there. She and a friend started interviewing them.
We loved the music, and we wanted to know everything about the people who played the music and what their lives were like. And we didn't have any money. We just had these cassette recorders, and we just turned them on and got a lot of really great stuff.
Over the years, she's interviewed Bill Monroe, the father of bluegrass, and guitarist and singer Elizabeth Cotton, the composer of the folk standard Freight Train.
Do you like traveling around, Libba?
Well, if I could get to a place without traveling, I'd like it better.
Later, Alice Gerard moved to North Carolina. She founded and edited a music magazine called the Old Time Herald, but she was no academic. In fact, Gerard says she dropped out of Antioch College without graduating. So when she was invited to teach a class on music and folklore at Duke University and the University of North Carolina a few years ago, Gerard was a little taken aback. Luckily, she had some help from longtime fan M.C. Taylor.
Remember the day you asked me what a syllabus was?
Yes, I do. What's a syllabus?
And he said, that was an amazing question.
I'd heard the word, of course, but I just really, you know, now I really had to know what it was because I had to sort of produce one.
You had to make one.
Taylor was a grad student in folklore at UNC. He helped Gerard get through the class and they became friends. At the same time, Taylor's band, His Golden Messenger, was attracting more attention, and they started talking about making an album together.
You listen to her older records, and the instrumentation is quite sparse. I wanted to stick to that aesthetic because I wanted her voice, and I wanted the songs up front.
Well, Weevil told the farmer, you'd better treat me right. Gonna eat up all your cotton, sleep in your granary.
Alice Gerard says she's always been drawn to tragic songs and murder ballads, and she's never felt the same passion for the happier side of country music.
I gravitate toward the darker material in traditional music and in, I guess, in my own songs, too. I've never had much success writing a really funny song or anything like that. The high lonesome sound is what appeals to me more than the skillet liquor sound, for example. You know, I like that too, but the stuff that really resonates at a deep level is the lonesome stuff.
Long, long ago, in the days of my childhood, fond were the memories when I stood at mother's knee.
That's where your voice is at its most compelling. When I hear you singing the stuff that feels minor key, that's where it's like, that is someone that has mastered the art of singing that sort of material.
It's the sound of a master sharing what she's learned with her collaborators, the same way Alice Gerard learned the craft half a century ago. Joel Rose, NPR News.
Gerard's album called Follow the Music came out last month. This story first aired on NPR's Morning Edition on October 3rd. You can find more music from Alice Gerard on our website, wvpublic.org.
Sometimes in the night I hear a lonesome old song or a ghostly fiddle calling.
After waiting months for his medical claim to be approved, a retired coal miner got word late September that his black lung benefits will cover the cost of a double lung transplant. We spoke with Robert Bailey in June when he was waiting to hear if Patriot Coal's insurance company would approve his appointment for a medical evaluation. He was approved for that appointment the day his story aired on West Virginia Public Radio. Then, shortly after that story was broadcast and posted to our website, Bailey was asked to testify about black lung in a congressional hearing. I met up once again with Mr. Bailey to get his reaction to the news that he doesn't have to worry about the financial part of his medical needs. We first met Robert Bailey at a black lung conference at Pipestem State Park back in June. He was carrying a bag with an oxygen tank on his back. Medical tubes carried oxygen from the tank around his ears and over his slender cheeks to his nose to keep him alive.
You might breathe as hard as you can breathe, but you can't feel the air. You're not getting any quality, no use out of it. Even though you are breathing, it just don't help you. And you feel your whole system shutting down, and like you're about to melt to the floor.
Bailey's doctor told him he needed a lung transplant in February of this year. Since then, he's been working towards the waiting list. As we reported in June, Bailey had to cancel an evaluation appointment as Patriot Coal's insurance company, Underwriter Safety and Claims, evaluated his request for coverage. We caught up with Bailey at his kitchen table in Princeton about 3 months later to recap his journey so far.
I felt like if they delayed much time, as far as just sending my records here or there, or not being in a hurry to get approvals or whatever, that this 2 to 3 years that I might have would be pushed over and I wouldn't make it to receive a transplant like some of the other coal miners who has lost their lives waiting on that phone call or waiting on that approval.
Bailey was contacted the day our report aired that his evaluation appointment was approved. Shortly after, he was asked to testify at a U.S. Senate subcommittee on employment and workplace that focused on black lung benefits.
Which that's the reason we had the Senate hearing, is to try to find a way for to make the time a lot shorter and give them their benefits sooner, because you need them now, not 5 years from now. And the same thing about a transplant is you really need it sooner, and you can't wait on it as long as you did for your black lung benefits, because life and death is the situation at this time.
According to the Office of Workers' Compensation, currently the federal black lung program has approved only 8 miners for lung transplants. To date, only 4 miners have had the transplant surgery after receiving approval, while others continue to wait on the transplant list established by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Bailey is not included in these numbers, as he was told it's Patriot Coal that will pay. Like so many miners diagnosed with black lung, fighting to live isn't the only battle. An investigation into the misconceptions of black lung and the maze of benefits by the Center for Public Integrity revealed a system in which coal miners were fighting an unfair battle for benefits. CPI found that the industry's go-to law firms, which had been withholding evidence that proved miners qualified for benefits because they had the debilitating disease, black lung. It also found that certain doctors rarely and sometimes never diagnosed patients to have the disease. Still, as coal and insurance companies dispute the claims, the Department of Labor covers the expenses, and at times, these cases can play out in court for years. But doctors tell Bailey he doesn't have many years left.
With the help of these people, it has given me the approval in a time that is needed, or it's not too late. So now I'm just waiting to hear from the hospital when it's time for me to go.
And although Bailey has renewed hope, he worries what the future holds for miners in need of a transplant that remain out of the public eye. Senator Rockefeller and Senator Bob Casey of Pennsylvania announced plans to work on a new bill to address issues revealed during the CPI investigation. Bailey hopes to see the bureaucratic process and backlog to be cleaned up as well.
If I'd known then what I know now, I wouldn't have been so keen to spend me working life in a cold sea.
While Mr. Bailey and so many other retired miners with black lung fight for benefits, provisions have been put in place to help prevent the disease in the first place. But current miners might have to face the same deadly disease. After regulations went into effect more than 40 years ago, the most severe kind of black lung almost disappeared from Appalachia. However, numbers started creeping up again in the 1990s due to weak enforcement and mining companies exploiting loopholes. Autopsies revealed that some miners that died in the Upper Big Branch explosion in 2010 had black lung, some with just a few years' experience. The disease is back at 1970s levels and affects not only the miners who go underground, but surface miners as well, according to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Black lung disease is caused by inhaling dust, which scars lung tissue. New regulations went into effect this past summer that would reduce the amount of exposure miners have to dust and close previous loopholes. Here and Now's Jeremy Hobson speaks with Dr. Robert Cohen, a black lung disease expert, and Gary Hairston, a retired miner from Beckley, West Virginia, who was diagnosed with black lung disease.
In Appalachia, black lung is back. It never really went away, but rates declined dramatically, and now they have come back up. Dr. Robert Cohen peer-reviewed the CDC study. He heads the Black Lung Clinic at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He's with us from WBEZ. Dr. Cohen, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, tell us, first of all, what black lung is exactly.
Well, black lung is a variety of types of lung diseases that are caused by people inhaling too much coal mine dust as part of their occupation. And the lung can really does not like this dust and can react in a number of ways, causing scarring, causing emphysema, chronic bronchitis, severe lung function impairment, and lots of morbidity and sometimes increased mortality from this exposure.
And now the rates of black lung are higher than they've been, as we said, in almost 4 decades. Tell us about this new study and what it found.
Well, the new study was looking at cases of the most severe and advanced type of black lung called progressive massive fibrosis, or others call it complicated pneumoconiosis. And this is where the scars in the lung are so large that they cause a lot more damage and really reflect very severe overexposures to coal mine dust. And what happened is NIOSH, the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, they found in the surveillance data that the rates of this severe form have been really increasing, and now in the mid-Appalachian states have really reverted to the levels that we saw before or at the very beginning of the Coal Mine Health and Safety Act when it was first enacted.
And why is that happening?
Well, there's lots of theories about this, but the bottom line is that coal miners are being overexposed, and these are miners that are working and had been working under what we considered modern dust controls. It's possible that as the methodology for cleaning coal from rock has been improved, that the mines are taking a lot of rock with the coal and overexposing miners to a lot of silica dust. We're also mining seams that are narrower, therefore we're taking a lot more rock above and below the seams. Miners are working long, long shifts, so have less time to really get their lungs cleaned out between shifts. They're working a lot of overtime, and that certainly could be part of it. And there's just clearly, people are not paying attention to the levels of dust that they're exposing the miners to in these mines.
Well, stand by, Dr. Cohen. I want to bring in Gary Hairston, who has worked in various coal mines for more than 27 years and then found out that he had black lung. Gary, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And tell us about that discovery when you learned that you did have black lung disease.
Well, it was kind of hard on me because I couldn't figure out why, if I get to run and stuff, and I couldn't get my breath and try to figure out what was the matter. And when I went to the doctor, and he told me that I had black lung. You know, you hear my dad got it and not really realizing what it can do to you, especially your breathing.
Well, and what has it done to you? What has it meant for you and how you live your life on a daily basis?
I can't do the things I love to do. Like, say, even watching my grandson play basketball, I like to be out there playing with him, but I know I can't do that. And even cutting grass, I got to do it in an interval or just pace myself. Where I used to could do it in an hour, now it's taking about 3 or 4 hours.
And you heard Dr. Cohen there talk about some of the reasons for the increase in the incidence of black lung disease. What do you think it was that caused you to get it?
Well, one mine that I worked at, we didn't hang no curtain. And like I said, we pretty much run in dust pretty much the whole shift. Like I say, working 10 to 12 hours a shift, and you in it the biggest part of the time.
Well, and you've talked about the fact that there's been gaming of the system, that people are giving false information to officials. Well, tell us about that.
Like, say, when I was in there, even when they had the dust meters, we either turned them off or we covered the hole up so that you really couldn't get the right read. And like, say, me really didn't know that the effect that it was doing to us. We just realized that we didn't think we were doing was helping the company and running the coal for them. Like, say, if we'd had the curtain and stuff hung, if we'd have did what it needed to do to keep the dust down.
Dr. Cohen, what do you make of what we're hearing there from Gary about what happened to him and how he has been impacted by it?
I think that there is no doubt that the technology exists to control the dust in the mines and to engineer it to safe levels in the atmosphere. Gary was talking about the ventilation curtains, which create a little tunnel to suck the dust and keep it out of the air. And there's water suppression sprays that high-pressure water that can be used to knock the dust down out of the air. There's a lot that can be done, but it does take investment and it does take commitment on the part of the industry to do it. And I think that what Gary's describing is a situation in the mine that he worked in where the operators were carrying out activities to defeat the surveillance that is mandated by the Mine Safety Health Administration and providing fraudulent data. And clearly he was overexposed to the dust in that mine.
Well, and there are these new mine health and safety regulations that went into effect over the summer. Would that have stopped Gary from getting black lung disease if they had been in effect back then?
I think that the new law that the Mine Safety Health Administration promulgated and went into effect August 1st would do a huge amount if it can be enforced, if it is enforced. It knocks down the permissible exposure limit for dust, and it really plugs a lot of loopholes in the laws that existed before in the regulations so that the operators have to really comply. And I think that the administration is trying to do as much as it can to enforce it.
Well, and I know that you just returned from a trip to China where you presented at an international conference on black lung in Beijing. How are things in Appalachia compared to the rest of the world when it comes to mine safety and the incidence of black lung disease?
Well, the incidence in China is horrific, and the exposure levels that were reported are also really, really astounding and frightening. They were discussing levels of dust exposure that are between 10 and 50 times the levels in the U.S., and they described 27,000 cases of pneumoconiosis that they diagnosed per year. About 90% of their occupational disease in China, they reported, was pneumoconiosis. So they have a huge problem over there. I would mention that they have 7 million coal miners in China. We have about 80,000 in the United States. So it's a huge industry and a huge problem. So thank goodness we're not at that level. But, you know, I think that we have to be world leaders in this and not followers. And I think we should take this resurgence of disease very seriously and act on it.
Well, and Gary Hairston, let me just finally go back to you. I'm sure it's not easy for you to have to talk about this. Why have you decided to be public about your struggle with this disease?
Well, I don't want the younger men to go through what I'm going through right now. And that, like I say, if I found out what kind of struggle it is, and everything I do, I got to do it in moderation. You know, I just can't go all out. So I don't want all these other young men going through what I'm going through right now.
Do you have kids in the business?
I did have one, and he quit.
Are you glad he got out of coal mining?
Yes.
Well, Gary Hairston, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
And Dr. Robert Cohen, who is the head of the Black Lung Clinic at the University of Illinois at Chicago, thank you as well.
You're welcome.
The few quid that they've given me is useless to me now. At least I've proved the truth of what they've done. Every breath's a living death and life's a living hell. It's only being angry drives me on. The devil is in the dust that arises from the coal. It rages in your chest as it battles for your soul. The devil is in the dust that arises from the coal. It rages in your chest as it battles for your soul.
It's time now to explore what's in a name. Where does the town of Wheeling, West Virginia get its name? We'll have the answer after the break. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Back in June, we heard the story from writer and historian Alan Fitzpatrick about how the town of Wheeling, West Virginia, may have gotten its name.
Wheeling is not an English word. In the Delaware language, there's two words linked together. Wheel, lunk. Wheel, lunk. Wheeling. And lunk means place of, and wheel means head or skull. What happened here? Mm-hmm. Something happened. Indians did not name places randomly for no reason.
So Wheeling is actually an anglified Delaware Indian word, Wheelunk, spelled W-E-E-L-U-N-K. Fitzpatrick began to explore the real history behind the legend that Wheeling is the place where an early white settler was murdered by natives. The legend most people in Wheeling tell is that a man's severed head was put on top of a pole as a warning to other settlers to stay away. But as Fitzpatrick began to uncover accounts by Native Americans, he began to see that the story was more complicated. He found evidence that Native Americans who had never even been to Wheeling were afraid of it. They talked about it often. And he found evidence that the skull was placed at Wheeling not as a warning to white people, but as a warning to other Native Americans. Fitzpatrick says that Native Americans feared something ominous and dangerous that was in Wheeling, or something bad that had happened there. He wasn't able to find out too many more details about the exact case of their fear, but he suspects that it had to have been something very significant. You can find more information about his book and hear the full interview on our website at wvpublic.org. So those are the town's ominous beginnings, but today people in Wheeling are using the word Wheelunk as part of a larger effort to help revive the town. Glennis Board of West Virginia Public Radio reports.
Wheelunk, do something. That's the name and theme or mission of the new online news initiative taking off in Wheeling. Wheelunk.com is a self-described Wheeling-centric website that wants to serve sophisticated local readers who care about their community, and it's launching November 1st. That's all according to the Wheelunk Facebook page that was born a few weeks ago and has since been growing in popularity. Yeah! A crowd gathered at Center Market in Wheeling recently to learn more about it.
My title is Wheelunker-in-Chief.
That's Jason Kegler. What he calls his real job is with West Liberty University, but he's been pedaling hard to get Wheelunk.com off the ground. Why Wheelunk? A name that, for many locals anyway, recalls an egregious act so violent that we still talk about it 300 years later? Well, it's a question Kegler gets a lot.
But we wanted something that was short, memorable, and kind of weird. And so Wheelunk is weird. The other thing about it business-wise is that when you search for Wheelunk, there's no Wheelunk that exists in the world, so you don't have to pay Google to come to the top. It will automatically be there for free. But also we have such passion for Wheeling, a little bit of touch back to the roots, even though we're looking to the future, but like we went way back.
Wheelunk is the brainchild of several Wheeling residents, predominantly Jason Kegler and Steve Burke, old high school friends who both moved away and then found themselves home again and in a mood to reinvent their hometown. Kegler says they're in good company, but there's a real need for a community platform to connect all the initiatives and activities that are happening all over the area. So Wheelunk.com is the idea that is crystallizing. So far, the three main objectives of the site are to provide a place for community dialogue, an all-encompassing interactive Wheeling calendar of events, and news.
Wheelunk is a platform to make connections. It's going to be every Wheelingite's homepage. We've envisioned people coming on there daily. It started as a fantasy a couple months ago, and then more and more people we talk to, they're like, yes, like, we need this. It's a void, so we feel like we've really touched on something.
The idea really began as an online newspaper to serve the Wheeling area. Perhaps that's why, so far, the only paid employee is the news editor, local talk radio personality Steve Novotny.
We're looking at travel. We're looking at entertainment. We're looking at food. We're looking at finance. There's going to be a lot of tax assistance for our readers during the major tax season. And then we're also going to tell a lot of stories about the people who are really the key of today's Wheeling.
Novotny is another homegrown Wheelonian. He says there's been a need for unbiased veteran journalism in Wheeling for some time.
We're going to cherish the past of Wheeling because that's what's made us. But finally, the focus is going to be on moving forward and looking into the future for tomorrow's Wheeling. You're going to see that no longer in Wheeling, West Virginia, is it passé to dream.
So far, all other Wheelunk employees are volunteers. They include marketing experts, web developers, graphic designers, party planners, and businessmen and women cohorts in general, who all share one thing for sure in common. They're all invested in Wheeling's future. The site, wheelunk.com, goes live November 1st. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Wheeling.
Folks down in southwestern Virginia are also using technology to try and revive their local economy through heritage tourism. A growing coalition of individuals and organizations believe that Clinch River, one of the most biodiverse river systems in North America, could itself be the backbone of a brand new economy in southwest Virginia. Rich Kirby of WMMT reports.
The Clinch River is not only one of the most beautiful rivers we have, it's also fascinating. One of the most biodiverse rivers in the world, running through intriguing geology and a majestic forest, wouldn't it be nice to learn about all this while floating the river? Well, there's an app for that.
Welcome to the Clinch. Even though this river may look tranquil and calm, did you know that you were actually floating one of the most biodiverse rivers in all of North America? This means that the Clinch has more types of wildlife than most other rivers on our continent. This is especially true for freshwater mussels, a group of small but important.
The app developed through a partnership with Clinch River Adventures in St. Paul and a project that we've had at the college looking at how to get information about biodiversity on the Clinch to users on the Clinch who are using it recreationally, because so many people float the Clinch but they never really know what they're seeing or why the river is so important.
Wally Smith teaches at the University of Virginia's College at Wise and works with the Clinch River Valley Initiative.
So we had a group of students at the college that developed the app, and it's housed through Google Earth and Google Maps, and it's an interpretive app that actually uses cultural information. We have some music from traditional Appalachian bands that have contributed music through the app, and then as well some information about biodiversity from the Clinch that we've synced up through a narrator. We have a professional storyteller who's contributed content, and as users float the Clinch, they'll be able to use this app and see where they are on the Clinch relative to different items on the Clinch, wildlife, habitats, information about biodiversity, and be able to play that content along with music as they float.
As you float the river today, this guide will help point out some of the local habitats and other natural features that are integral to the Clinch and its wildlife, including the river's incredible array of freshwater mussels. Keep an eye out for these and other features as you float, and enjoy your time on the Clinch.
Yes, my name's Terry Ann Funk, and my husband and I are the owners of Clinch River Adventures in St. Paul, Virginia.
This summer, Clinch River Adventures worked with Wally Smith and his students.
As you may know, the Clinch is the most biodiverse river in the U.S. and second behind the Amazon. Wally and I had talked about it, and he had a class, and the students actually did the legwork for the information that was used within the app. And then after he received the grant, he hired a narrator to actually narrate, and then I'm pretty sure it was UVA Wise's band who actually did the background music for it. And so having all three of those come together and complete this, and then of course the app itself is like none other in the world. The Amazon, actually Wally and I did some research on this, and you know, the Amazon actually offers a tutorial going down the river via tablets. And so this is like none other in the U.S., kind of like the river. It's like none other in the U.S. And so now the app, of course, is up and going, and it's just super exciting to be able to take your natural assets that you have that we've looked at all of our lives, because I'm from St. Paul, Virginia, and we've looked at all of our lives, and, you know, we just think, oh, it's a river, but it's not just a river. It's the Clinch River, and the reason that that is so spectacular is because, you know, the mussels and biodiversity, and so now we're able to not only promote our area, but also promote the river, so.
The bridge crossing the Clinch near this point is an example of one of Southwest Virginia's most important economic resources. This particular railroad line helps in the transport of coal out of the mountains north of the Clinch Valley to distribution centers and prep plants far beyond. Historically, coal has been the economic foundation of the Clinch Valley, with many towns and settlements having their origin in coal camps that boomed through the early to mid.
Terry Ann Funk says people are enthusiastic about the app.
Once that they realize that first it's available, and second that it's not only about the river, it's about our heritage, it's about the environment, it's about the coal industry, they absolutely love it. And so it's great to finally take something besides coal, hopefully, and which I'm, you know, for the coal industry. I don't mean that in a bad way. But it's great to be able to have something else to fall on, for instance, like tourism-related and stuff. So it's really exciting that we have something to promote.
We're piloting it right now from Castlewood to St. Paul. So a small, I think, 2.5-mile stretch of the Clinch, about maybe a 90-minute float. And we're hoping, if this works well, to expand that to other areas of the Clinch all throughout the river.
We've looked in expanding it both ways. For instance, from St. Paul down, and it ends in St. Paul. So, and then also expanding it up to Cleveland, because Cleveland's a kind of a big feature of the Clinch, because there's a lot of mussels there and a lot of flora and fauna. Right now, he and I have talked about really just marketing this more heavily so that we can get more people aware of it. Because once that someone tries this, they realize how important that it really is to our community and our heritage. So,
as you begin to wind your way downriver towards the outskirts of St. Paul, you may begin to notice some rock outcrops above the water, particularly in the forest along the country road that parallels the river. These rocks are a fine example of the karst, or limestone-dominated topography, that dominates much of the Clinch Valley. Karst landscapes harbor a variety of fascinating natural features, including caves.
I knew it would be a great partnership for us because, you know, we already have people on the river. And so a lot of people come for fun, but a lot of people doesn't realize that it can be an educational experience as well. So I'm really looking forward to the partnership in the future. So,
Terry Ann Funk of Clinch River Adventures in St. Paul, Virginia. We also heard Wally Smith of the University of Virginia's College at Wise. The app that Dr. Smith and his students developed is narrated by Jane Branham, with music from the Empty Bottle String Band. To see more online, go to visitclinchriver.com and look at Explore Our Biodiversity. Reporting for WMMT, I'm Rich Kirby.
In Kentucky, job growth in the bourbon industry has doubled in the last 2 years. Alan Lightall from WUKY in Lexington has more on this story.
The report by the University of Louisville's Urban Studies Institute shows that the number of licensed distilling companies have tripled in the past 2 years, from 10 to 31. The bourbon sector's workforce now tops 15,400, up from nearly 8,700 workers 2 years ago. Distilling now contributes $3 billion in gross state product to Kentucky's economy every year, up from $1.8 billion 2 years ago, leading Democrat Governor Steve Beshear to say that the industry's progress is unrivaled and unparalleled.
We have invested in the bourbon industry. They've been partners with us. And together, we have caused this phenomenal growth to take place. I love the fact that these new jobs that are being created are paying an average of $91,000 a year per job. Now, that is a salary that anybody anywhere in this country can live on, raise a family on, and have a great life.
But does this bourbon boom now mean there will be a bourbon bust later? Eric Carlson, editor-in-chief of Business Lexington magazine, says, don't bet on it.
No, at this point, I don't think that's the case, unless the billions of people in Asia all of a sudden decide they don't like whiskey. We're going to be doing just fine here in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. While there has been an incredible increase in popularity in the younger demographics, you know, you look at the Brooklyn types, or even here in Kentucky, people who love their bourbons and their higher-end things. What's driving the market isn't that. It's Asia. All this is coming from Asia. Recently, we saw Beam Global be purchased by Suntory, a whiskey company out of Japan, because they want to get those channels developed into Japan, China, and the rest of Asia.
The now more than 30 distilleries in Kentucky signify the most the state has seen since Prohibition ended. Reporting in Lexington, I'm Alan Lytle.
Middleton has spent the past 6 years working on a series of documentaries dealing with the vanishing traditions about Appalachia. Now he's working on a new documentary called Commonwealth Curiosities, which explores the weird old roadside attractions and unique curiosities in the state of Kentucky. Moorhead State Public Radio's Jordan Simonson has more.
Working at MSU as a mass communications professor for 7 years, Stephen Middleton has been busy with more than just his students. He is also a cinematographer who films various documentaries that cover the Appalachian region. He has brought to life stories about people who collect scrap metal for a living, who become unlikely wrestlers, and those who are introducing traditional music back to a younger generation. While growing up, the Phoenix native says that he saw one movie that inspired him to want to make documentaries.
There was one particular movie, and it's, I know it's a cheesy, hokey movie that inspired me, but it was a Tim Burton movie, Ed Wood, about Edward D. Wood Jr., voted the worst filmmaker of all time. But it was watching that movie, seeing him like have this hodgepodge group of people trying to make these movies with no budget, inspired me.
Middleton's most recent production was Never Get Out Alive. It featured the death and dying traditions of Appalachia and its funeral industry. Middleton says it was a very heavy topic, and after making that piece, he decided his next documentary had to be something livelier.
I'm pretty jovial as a person, you know. I'd rather smile and laugh than be serious sometimes. And it was a really deep subject, and even though I really appreciated all of that and loved the support, I was like, I need to do something lighter. You know, as a kid, my dad, he loved stopping in strange places and strange shops, and we'd always be on the road so much traveling. He would go into these places, world's largest rose bush, you know, giant alligator, you know, man-eating chicken type places on Route 66, and we'd stop in these places. It was so cool. I want to do a documentary on these kind of strange roadside attractions, if there is any.
Middleton found 6 strange attractions in the Commonwealth, and his new documentary, Commonwealth Curiosities, focuses on those eccentric places. He traveled across the state and visited the Northeast Kentucky Museum, the Kentucky Reptile Zoo, Wild Things in Kentucky, and the Hillbilly Gardens, to name just a few.
My name is Stephen Middleton. For the past 6 years, I've had the great opportunity to make a series of documentaries about the place I love and call home, the state of Kentucky. Throughout all of my travels within the Commonwealth, I have always noticed Kentucky is one unique state. With new highway and modern travel arteries, you see less and less of the real Kentucky, the one that I remember as a kid of roadside stops, curious attractions. One of the lasting memories from my childhood was driving cross-country with my family, stopping to view the array of roadside attractions in what I would call the real America. I'm traveling from north to south, east and west, to see if this real Kentucky still exists.
Stephen brought back some really fantastic interviews with the people who maintain these roadside attractions, like Jim Plummer, who runs the Northeast Kentucky Museum in Olive Hill, Kentucky.
Most people are moving pretty quickly, and they're on a schedule. There's quite a bit of history in here. You know, there's some quality items, a lot of Kentucky history, a lot of U.S. history. I'm in and out of here some in the summers, closed completely in the winter. So, I'm a roadside attraction, I guess.
And Kristen Wiley at the Kentucky Reptile Zoo and Venom Sales in Slade, Kentucky.
You know, I tell kids in educational programs the number one way to avoid being bitten by a snake is to not mess with it. You know, just leave it alone if you see a snake. I certainly don't recommend it as like something you want to do, but it is a risk of working with them.
And most of you out there are probably like me and had no idea that in Kentucky is the location of the only ventriloquist museum in the world. Here's Lisa Sweezy, the curator of the museum in Fort Mitchell, Kentucky.
But this is the only museum of its kind in the world. Everybody else's collections are private and they just show them to their friends. I am not a ventriloquist. I'm a certified high school math teacher who just kind of fell into this wonderful job. No, Mr. Berger did not want the curator to be a ventriloquist out of respect for the ventriloquist who had donated or sold their dummies to him.
If you want to watch the trailer for the documentary, go to our website, wvpublic.org. You can also see Commonwealth Curiosities when it launches on November 18th at 6:30 in the evening at Coffee Tree Books in Moorhead, Kentucky. Speaking of road trips, NPR's Linda Wertheimer recently made a trip to visit the Homer Laughlin factory in West Virginia, home of Fiesta Ware. While most American ceramic factories closed long ago, unable to compete with Made in Japan or Mexico, Homer Laughlin is still going strong. The factory opened more than 141 years ago. The plant employs about 1,000 people, and you might be familiar with the company's most famous product. It's that brightly colored pottery called Fiesta. Linda Wertheimer has more.
My mother collected a warm yellow. My Fiesta is deep cobalt blue, just so you know where I stand. Fiesta is about half Homer Laughlin's business. The other half is dinnerware for hotels and the sturdy plates and cups you find at chain restaurants. Walk into the big, dim factory buildings, dusty and smelling of mud, and you might be back at Homer Laughlin's beginnings in the 19th century. People are sitting quietly in pools of light, carefully attaching handles to greenware, that's not yet fired coffee cups. Decorators are painting bands of color on glazed plates.
I'm just a hand liner. I put lines on. The orders tell me I need to put a 3/32, an eighth from the edge, and a 3/64, a 16th below, and a 3/64 verge.
Kevin Manypenny has worked in the Homer Laughlin factory since he was a teenager. He twirls a plate, dips a brush in brown glaze, and paints three delicate lines on the plate's edge. This plate is for a Boston restaurant. Manypenny finishes the plate and then tosses it onto a broad moving belt as if he were skipping a stone across water. Who plays catcher down the other end?
A younger brother.
James Manypenny, I go by Jim. I'm a kiln placer. I place ware on the kiln. It's not supposed to hit the floor.
He calls the ovens which fire the china kills, spelled K-I-L-N-S, but potters don't pronounce that N. 7 out of 8 of the Manypenny siblings and their parents have worked at this factory, and there are dozens of families like theirs. Brothers founded the company, Homer and Shakespeare Laughlin, presumably a literary family. They jumped on a new fashion for whiter, more refined dinnerware. Sarah Vaudry of the area's Ceramic Museum described their beginnings.
They were the young whippersnappers in the pottery world, and they were the ones who ended up successfully firing 4 kilns worth of whiteware before any of the other potteries could, and then they won a prize of $5,000, and that's what launched the Laughlin brothers into pottery production on a big scale.
Around the turn of the 20th century, the company changed hands. The new team built a new plant on the West Virginia side of the river, and those long, low factory buildings are still in use today. Then, in the 30s, the company created Fiesta, cheap, colorful, cheerful dinnerware. It was a hit even in the Depression. In 1948, Homer Laughlin really stepped up the production of plates and bowls. They designed and built their own machine inside the factory. Dave Conley, a longtime employee and unofficial company historian, calls it the Big Flat Automatic.
This is the Flat Automatic Digger. You've got 3 machines here, and each one has 2 heads on it, so theoretically we could be making 6 different items at a time.
He said that's 3,000 dozen pieces every 8-hour shift. People who make dishes talk in dozens. You'll have to do the math. I'm giving you the history because it's all still happening. The buildings, the machines, the kills, Fiesta, and the owners are all still going. Of course, there have been improvements. Computers control the firing now. A 3D printer speeds the design process. Ceramic engineers found a way to make glaze shiny without using lead, all done in-house.
The people that owned our company have always put profits back into the plant to modernize. And we've always had state-of-the-art equipment. And I call that state-of-the-art even though it's as old as it is. It's almost 60 years old.
He's talking about the Big Flat Automatic. It still works. By this time, we had walked the entire 37-acre factory floor and were standing on a loading dock. But inside the old buildings, on the chilly day we were there, with fog pouring off the Ohio River and drifting into the windows, we watched the ware come out of the fire, magically transformed. Creamy orange, intense red, vivid turquoise. Bright pottery stacked in bins and crates piled all over the place.
I remember the first time I actually went to the facility and looking around, and I'm thinking, boy, am I back in the 1940s or what? I mean, even the office, it isn't all spruced up. It's the old look, and they're focused on making product and not being flashy.
That's Bruce Smith, head of the union representing the pottery workers. He says while nothing about Homer Lachlan is flashy, the workers do make decent money.
You know, they are good jobs, and they're making a living, being able to buy a home and raise a family and retire with some dignity.
Both management and labor consider that an achievement.
I'm very proud to have kept this business here in the Ohio Valley. It's very important to us.
Elizabeth Wells McIlvain is the first woman to lead Homer Lachlan and the fourth generation of her family to run the plant. Her immediate family now owns most of the business. She told us that Homer Lachlan China stopped producing Fiesta for a time in the 70s. Harvest Gold and Avocado Green didn't sell. But in 1986, Bloomingdale's department store came calling, looking for a retro China for their stores, and Homer Lachlan made a typical, practical decision. Restart an old line. Revive Fiesta for retail sale, along with their existing hotel and restaurant business.
We have two sides of the business, and that's helped us tremendously because it seems when one side of the business, the retail side of the business, is flourishing, the hotel side is having problems, is having difficulties, and vice versa.
It helps that Fiesta has a big fan base. Collectors stand in line for hours to get into the factory tent sales. Fans meet, they swap, they critique the company's color choices, and they wait for the new Fiesta color, which is unveiled each March.
Oh, they always have suggestions. The one year, they all wanted fuchsia, and they all arrived to Homer Lachlan to go on their tours dressed in whatever fuchsia they had. That was their silent but very loud statement.
The folks at the factory steered us away from fuchsia as next year's color, manufacturing problems, they said. But they offered no color clues, says Miss McIlvain.
That's a very deep, dark secret. Not to be told.
I'm Linda Wertheimer for NPR News.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from NPR, WBUR's Here and Now in Boston, WMMT, Apple Shop, Mountain Community Radio in Whitesburg, Kentucky, Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WUKY in Lexington, Kentucky, and WVTF in Charlottesville, Virginia. Music in today's show was by Alice Gerard, Ed Pickford, Andy Agnew, Tyler Mullins, and Kevin McLeod. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter @InAppalachia or @WVJessicaYLilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at WVPublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Thank you.